it's a pleasure to welcome back Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University, economics professor.
Nice to be back with you.
You had an interesting article from Forbes, A Total Trade War. People are either terribly concerned or just completely dismissing the threat of our top trading partners getting fed up with the U.S. Can you tell us more?
Well, yeah, they are getting fed up and they're slapping tariffs on us. This is not a joke. You know, these tariffs are being applied as we speak, and more appear to be coming. Trump has threatened $200 billion in tariffs on Chinese products, you know, and ultimately perhaps putting on tariffs on every single Chinese product, and they'll, of course, do the same with us. But since we're a number of products, their tariffs, in order to retaliate, are going to be focused on things like soybean at a much higher rate. So it could put the soybean industry in, you know, if not out of operation, certainly out of profitability for quite a while. And they can switch suppliers, and we never see a soybean recovery. So the idea that this guy can go into a shop and start swinging a wrecking ball and think everything is going to be fine, it just shows the inanity of this. They're not going to put up with it. So trying to negotiate a separate deal with Mexico and leaving out Canada, well, Canada's not going to be not accepting that. So we could have a breakdown of trade with Canada. It's not clear whether Mexico will ultimately, you know, it's not clear how much of what was decided with Mexico is actually just a show or was substantive. But the whole thinking process that you're here, the whole thought process that we need to have balanced trade. We have a country that's hooked on consumption. We're kind of consumption junkies. And the reason that we're running a trade deficit is because we're consuming so much that we're saving so little. We have so little income left over to save. Therefore, we can and cannot invest because we don't have any wherewithal to invest at a reasonable rate. And other countries see investment opportunities in the U.S. and they come and invest and they bring their capital goods over, and that shows up as a trade deficit. So the reason that we're running a trade deficit has nothing to do with unfair trade practices. It has everything to do with 4% or 3% national saving rate, which used to be 15% in 1950. And any decent economist who has studied international trade will tell you that. I'm not even an expert in international, you know, I don't specialize in international trade, but economics 101, it's crazy. Started a trade war with complete crazy notions about trade. You know, there are some legitimate concerns about intellectual property interacting with China and with their requirements that they have over 51% ownership of foreign companies that invest in China. Well, you respond to that specifically, not via a huge war. You know, if you have, say, okay, look, if you want to play that way, we'll play the same way with you. Namely, your companies, when they invest here, have to hand over all their intellectual property, and we have to have 51% ownership. You just pass the law, treat them symmetrically, and they'll back off. It doesn't, but now he's made this a mano a mano, who's got the bigger cojones here. President Xi in China is running a country with 1.2 or so people, and they're all nationalistic, and they've been pumped up to be nationalistic, and he cannot back down publicly. Canadian Prime Minister is not going to publicly back down, and this is all becoming a very big public. It's trying to say publicly, I'm going to intimidate these people.
Obviously, we've had some inconsistencies and some imbalances within our global trade and with our top trading partners for decades.
And even today, we have very high tariffs on things that we're protecting with other countries. So it's not like our tariffs on average have been a lot lower than those of our competitors. It's not the case at all. So there are grievances on both sides. It wasn't a crisis before he got into office. It doesn't need to be a crisis now.
Kind of veering us back here, though, to the economic picture, you point out in some of your recent literature, we're seeing trade agreements around the world, especially between, you know, the BRICS nations, in particular China, Russia, Asia, and then again with the Middle East, which has kind of been left out of a lot of these discussions. I'd like your thoughts on the significance of that and how it might strategically hurt the United States economically.
Yeah, we've engaged in a trade war with the European Union and China. Canada and Mexico, collectively, their economies are about 2.5 times.
Look at Europe. I mean, they're upset with us over our 25% tariff on their autos, right?
Yeah, I don't know if that's been actually implemented yet or that's just a threat. There's certainly been steel taxes, tariffs. But even the European Union by itself has a bigger economy than ours, probably by 10, 15%. The idea that the U.S. can call the shots on its own, they are going to go around us. And we will be left in the dust. Our country is on a long-term path to become economically insignificant. We need to understand, as part of this entire conversation, the U.S. right now has 17% of world GDP. After World War II, we were probably around 40, 50% of world GDP. Now we're 17%. By the end of the century, given the demographic projections of the U.N., and we're going to have another two Chinas in the world in terms of population, and if we get catch-up productivity growth in the areas where this demographic increase is projected to happen, the U.S. will have at the end of the century in 2100 just 5% of world GDP. It will be to the world's economy what Germany is to the world's economy today, which is a bit player, not a country that can call the shots. We won't have the economic strength to police the world, to wage wars with no end and no clear path to an end or victory, or not even a definition of what victory is. Endless numbers of years in Afghanistan, we're going on to 18 years. Entire kind of stance of the U.S., and it's not just the current president administration, the Democrats also, the entire set of politicians have this mindset that America is going to maintain its hegemonic position through time. It's not in the economic cards. It's not in the demographic cards. It's not in the productivity growth rate cards. We can't even get, in the last year and a half, we're saying that this economy is better than it's ever been. It's not better than it's ever been. There's been zero wage growth in the last 12 months, zero real wage growth. Just look at the BLS numbers. The 6 months before that, we had about 0.5% real wage growth. So over 18 months, this we've had on an annual basis, less than 0.5%, basically about 0.25%, less, 0.33% real wage growth. And that's not economic progress. That's stagnation. That's what you see other countries growing in real terms. Ours is sitting still. The fact that everybody's employed but making no money is not a great achievement.
And, you know, we are seeing the implications of, or fallout, you might say, of some of these policies. For instance, with Canada, our neighbor to the north, we're seeing an increase in at least 10% in lumber used in new home construction, which is hitting new home sales, increasing the typical home, according to a recent report.
That could precipitate another crash, economic crash, like we saw in 2008. People are leveraged again, and it doesn't take much to panic the economy. Right now, everybody's we've got a bull run. Everybody's upbeat. He's produced an environment for economic collapse. I view the collapse we saw in 2008 as indicative of what we in economics call multiple equilibria, where people collectively panic. They collectively fire. They fire because they think other people are firing. And then you go from great times to terrible times from 1 minute to the next. And that's really what we saw in 2008. 10 years today, if you go back to September 15th, when Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, the firing started happening within a few weeks, and it reached 700,000 unemployed in December.
This idea you brought up of multiple equilibria, if you will, I mean, we can see these issues precipitate into a confluence of negative events that hit at the same time, and that can lead to like an avalanche of difficulties, as we saw in the Great Recession, they call it 2008-2009. What do you say to folks who maybe are pointing to the revision in NAFTA? Can you find any positives there for the U.S.?
I'm sure there's some good things, but I mean, let's take, for example, the requirement that the Mexicans pay their workers $16 an hour. their auto workers. Now they're being paid $3 an hour. This is really the basic dilemma here for the U.S. workers, which is we don't have a very well-educated workforce or well-trained. We don't have the kind of apprenticeship programs that they have in Germany and Switzerland. So our kids are coming into the workforce with very bad, very poor education, elementary school and high school, generally not great apprenticeship programs. They're not hooked in with companies who have been guiding them, and they're not as productive as they need to be. And then they've got competition from countries all around the world, not just in Mexico, where people, there's so many workers who are well-trained and very disciplined, are willing to work at dramatically lower wages. And that's why almost everything you buy these days that's been, you know, actually made by a person is being brought in from China or some other emerging country. So if we put on, if we require the Mexicans to pay their workers $16 an hour, we'll destroy the auto industry in Mexico, and it'll just move to a different country. So it's not like we're going to get a real wage increase for the Mexicans. It's what we're going to do is get a real wage reduction for the Americans, because every worker in the U.S. who is trying to buy a car is going to face a higher price of cars. If we extended that rule that any auto part, any car has to be delivered here based on labor that's paid, let's say, $3,000 an hour. Why not take it to the extreme? Then the only cars that will be made here will be made by GM and Ford and Chrysler, and they'll be priced at a much higher level price, and the American workers' paycheck will buy less. So we're not talking about a real wage hike for the Mexicans. We're talking about a real wage cut for the Americans. That's what his policy and trade is producing, which is real economic decline in the U.S. It's one thing if we had some special leverage, you know, some way in which we could manipulate trade tariffs to get much higher prices in the world market for our goods that we're making. That's not the strategy here, and that's not the preconditions.
We're not going to give any specific investment advice today, but you have pointed out your grave concerns with regard to U.S. Treasuries. You see this and view this as one of the more risky assets, which so many advisors would say that should be a core component, maybe 50%. You know, as a person approaches retirement, for every 10 years, you want to increase your bond exposure another 10%. That's the typical rule of thumb, primarily due to that $200 trillion in U.S. debt you see in liabilities.
Yeah, the U.S. Government is entirely bankrupt. Almost all our liabilities, 90%, are off the books. So we're not facing $20 trillion in official debt. We're facing $200 trillion in official and unofficial debt. An example of an unofficial debt is $34 trillion in unfunded liabilities to pay for Social Security benefits. That number is hidden away in the trustees report of the Social Security Administration. So we've got these massive off-the-book liabilities, Medicare, Medicaid, defense spending into the future. The country's broke. So when a country's broke, they typically tend to print money. That can lead to inflation. We're already seeing inflation picking up, long-term rates going up a bit. So the big concern with the fiscal side is that long-term rates will go up and that long-term treasuries will sink in value. If we have a recession, there will probably be a flight to safety, and treasuries will do better on that score, especially short-term treasuries. So I would say the real danger is with long-term U.S. treasuries, and short-term treasuries might be relatively safe and might even be a decent hedge against what could be a major recession if we get, you know, people get sufficiently pessimistic collectively. If there's a triggering event here, for example, we slap $200 billion tariffs on $200 billion worth of U.S. Chinese products, and the Chinese do that the next day to us, that could be the kind of triggering event that could flip our equilibrium to one of recession, not expansion. In terms of investments, yeah, I think the stock market is quite risky, even independent of Trump and the trade war that's emerging. The fact is that price-earning ratios are extremely high, and I don't think this is a good time to be in the stock market. I think looking at bonds of countries that are well run, like Canadian bonds, and countries, you know, Canada is a country that has an undervalued exchange rate, it seems. That might be a play that might be worth considering. I'm just very nervous about the market, that people are underestimating the damage that a trade war can produce. And we're heading into a trade war. You know, we've already started a trade war. Bob Woodward just wrote an entire 465 or so page book describing in minute detail, and he's running our world economy, our world economic policy. So one should be adopting the title of Woodward's book, which is Fear. One should be taking on fear. And when you're fearful about when you realize that there's more uncertainty about the economy, the world economy, and the U.S. economy, and there's got to be more uncertainty today than there was 3 years ago, what you do, according to economics, is you cut back on your exposure to risky assets. So you time the market not to try and get a higher return, but you time it to lower your risk. And that's what economics predicts. So the mantra that we've heard in the last 50 or so years by economists and Wall Street, that you don't try and time the market, nobody can beat the market, that's true. But there's another lesson from economic theory that has not been expressed, which is when things get risky, you get out. And things are more risky. So everybody should be moving out, I think, given the extra risk. I'm sure the market's going to crash tomorrow. What I am sure is that we've got more risk today than we had yesterday, yesterday being a couple years ago. People should, according to economic theory, finance theory, play it safer. Entirely eliminate your stock holdings, but it means you cut them back.
Can you envision a scenario where our key trading partner, China, with trillions of dollars in U.S. treasuries, presses the nuclear option, divests large sums, maybe gives up on our trade due to this trade war, thereby just crushing the greenback and causing Argentine or even Venezuelan-style currency issues, maybe even inflation? And in such a scenario, would a strong hedge like precious metals protect investors somewhat from the fallout?
Yeah, absolutely. We should be diversified. If you're asking about gold and other metals, for sure, that should be part of a balanced portfolio. Help avoid to diversify against the risk. And yeah, there's all kinds of things that could happen if things get sufficiently out of hand. China's sitting on lots of U.S. bonds. They could dump them on the market, probably gradually, so they don't suffer a loss themselves. But if word of that gets out, it will lead interest rates to go sky high. And then you have a lot of people, and then they'll go even higher because people realize that the U.S. government has to pay interest on, at a much higher rate, on its large official debt. All these things interact can lead to the kinds of things we saw in 2008, which is serial financial collapse and economic collapse. One thing leading to the next, the domino is falling. Goes down, AIG goes down the next week. Citigroup has to be, Merrill Lynch goes the same weekend as Lehman Brothers. Citigroup has to be bailed out, and the stock market falls 60%. Yes, it fell 60%, I think, between 2008, September 15th, 2008, the middle of 2009. I believe it dropped about 60%, the S&P.
Exactly, and without all the helicopter drops and the rest of the bailouts, can you imagine what would have really happened? I mean, it could have been a 1929 to 1932, like 89-90% drop.
Yeah, 86% between 1929 and the bottom, the trough in 33, I believe, was an 86% drop in the stock market. And yeah, we've got Dodd-Frank and the Republican Congress right now. It could still be a Republican Congress. And Dodd-Frank is very clear that the government cannot bail out companies like they could prior to the passage of Dodd-Frank. The whole impetus of Dodd-Frank was that Wall Street should not be bailed out. What they didn't do is fundamentally fix the banking system so that we wouldn't have leveraged financial intermediaries, middlemen, who could bring down the financial exchange and could in effect blackmail us to bail them out. They never fixed anything fundamental. They just rebuilt the thing in straw. And it's about to, we could have another hurricane. So, and be in a worse position to deal with it because the Dodd-Frank has put on certain more restrictions on what the Fed and the Treasury can do.
You know, clearly the previous act that separate the banking powers from the investment banking side and our key money lenders, when that came to pass, it allowed for what we saw build up to 2008, 2009. And it's never really been addressed by legislators. So you could argue we're just setting up for another 1929 style collapse, which could maybe even be worse this time, because we don't have the economic base, you might agree, the manufacturing base, to pull us back up. As we close, any parting thoughts for listeners?
These are very dangerous times for us personally, economically, and for our nation's political cohesion, for its democracy. Thinking seriously about such a danger to ourselves and to our children and to the world, I'm not saying whether I like them or not. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. You have to be thinking about the country, so I would appeal to people to think about how they're going to vote in November. Just read Woodward's book about pulling, in effect, described it as an implicit coup d'etat. So anyway, that's my parting thought. I appreciate being on the show. My website is kotlikoff.net.
We'll make sure we have that link up, kotlikoff.net. And of course, amazon.com has some of his latest books there as well. Professor Kotlikoff, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.